Guys, it's finally here, the mythical episode. Today, as you can probably see from the headline, we are tackling the big kids question. So if you're new here, we have been talking about this for quite some time now. As 31 and 32-year-old women respectively, we've definitely noticed a broader shift in people really thinking carefully about whether or not to have children. We want this episode to appeal to all of our gorgeous listeners. We have many listeners that have kids. We've actually had some incredible insight from those listeners, and
we're going to be sharing that later.
We also are looking, of course, at the child-free by choice movement and the incredible joys that come with that. Perhaps a good place to start, though, would be the Office for National Statistics' latest numbers, which came out just a few weeks ago and I think speak to exactly this conundrum. It's not just us feeling it clearly. And based on your guys' feedback, it is something that is really playing on the minds of lots of people, both those with children and without, as well as those considering whether or not to have them.
Yes. And also not just women, but men as well. We have a male listener contingent and queer.
I thought you were going to say one, a male.
And a male listener. Hello, my boyfriend. And your boyfriend.
No, he doesn't even listen.
No.
No, we do have male listeners. And we've also been having this conversation with lots of our male friends. So it's certainly not something that's unique to women only. While, of course, acknowledging the fact that people that have reproductive capabilities are the ones to shoulder the burden in a lot of these conversations.
And also, it's worth noting, the blinding obvious is that me and Kathleen don't yet have children. So we come from a maybe more limited perspective than some of our listeners who have families.
Which is precisely why we really did want to draw on your guys' experiences. And we have, as we've said, the most incredible breadth of commentary covering all aspects of parenthood.
Exactly. And of course, we hope that this episode will be interesting to everyone, regardless of circumstance, whether you be a heteronormative couple or a queer couple or solo parenting. So in February, the Office for National Statistics revealed that the fertility rate, which FYI measures the average number of children a woman of childbearing age will have, in England and Wales has dropped to its lowest in 83 years, with British women having fewer children than at any point since at least 1939, which is when comparative data began.
Yeah, that's when records literally began.
Literally. So it is becoming what was described as a slow burn economic crisis. Campaigners have said that having children now has been a luxury lifestyle choice. So in terms of the data, fertility levels have fallen to 1.49 children per woman in 2022. Compare that to 2021, it was 1.55. In 1915, it was 3.1. So it has more than halved. And women need to be having an average of 2.1 children each to maintain a stable population size without the need for immigration, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development.
So a fact that I've found particularly fascinating, while I don't think it was released by the ONS, it has been widely touted. Women born in 1990 are the first cohort in history where half were still childless by their 30th birthdays. So that's really speaking to our generation, isn't it? I'm 1991, you're 1993.
Yeah.
Millennials are classed as those between 1981 and 1996. And research published in June 2023 by Oxford University found that fertility is declining in women across all educational groups. So this isn't something that's only relevant to perhaps one sector of society. It's also relevant to men. Male fertility is declining. So in 1973, the average man had 100 million sperm per millimeter. Now it's 49 million.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, if that pace continues, we're told that technically every man in the Western world could be infertile by 2045. Anyway, I want to caveat that by saying that this is not about scaremongering. This is absolutely not what we want to do here. We're not here to have a kind of death knell on your fertility. This is a broader conversation about the cultural forces at play that have really changed for a whole generation of people what it means to be a parent. And I think lots of us, I'm sure we're speaking for many of you listening here, have really had to redefine what we want out of our lives and question the kind of societal narrative that most of us, if not all of us, should just be automatically shoehorned into parenthood.
And I think the reason we're doing this two-episode special is because this is actually like a very deeply personal conundrum for me and Kathleen. Like, this is something we as friends talk about a hell of a lot and have done in the last 1 year or 2 years specifically, I would say.
Since I turned 30, I think so. It's that very cultural cliche that the minute you hit 30, it becomes an all-consuming issue, almost something that 100%. Just wasn't present in your life in any meaningful way before, suddenly is everywhere. People asking you when you're going to get married, when you're going to have kids, are you going to have kids? other people, you know, you're on your Facebook and you see half of your primary school are popping them out. And
yeah.
You wonder, what am I going to do? I don't know.
We have I have a WhatsApp group with my university friends. There's about, I think, 25 of us or 30 of us on that group, hell of a lot of people. And we are constantly updating each other on who's got engaged and who's having kids. And it's obviously an amazing, I love those announcements. They're amazing. But I think for many people who are single, or for me, for instance, who's not yet sure of what they want, each announcement does bring all, as well as joy and so much happiness for the person announcing it, huge anxiety.
And ambivalence like, about your own life, yeah, and if you're making the like, right choices.
Oh God, another one, and I still yet don't know.
Am I some kind of like oddball? I think actually it would be really helpful. I'm absolutely not calling you an oddball, by the way. I'm putting it out there. Like we say, is that whenever you question the accepted narrative, you feel that you're somehow different.
It's so interesting because, not to get all too like Freudian about it, but when I was younger, my parents did notice that I was never the one to play with dolls. My sister would play with dolls. I never did.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was way more about like imaginary games. And
being in your own creative world, exactly. Instead of playing with baby dolls.
Not that my sister isn't creative, but she was much more drawn to that. And she's a teacher. So I would say that as a teacher, you do have a kind of instinct.
A nurturing side, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you have to be a good teacher, at least. And I did try and be a teacher for a year and it did not work out. Stories for another day. But so that's just interesting context to my background. And also interestingly, I would say that my parents have never, ever pressured me to have children. I honestly don't think they have ever asked me if I'm going to have children. And I do find that interesting because I think that's quite unusual, actually. And I also think that it's been very liberating in some senses because I haven't felt that familial pressure that I think a lot of other people do.
Yeah.
I think that you felt.
Yeah.
But also sometimes I'm like, hang on, why hasn't my mum asked me? Like, do they not want grandchildren? Or is it because they don't? Like, sometimes you like get paranoid in your head about it. Like, why haven't they asked me?
Do they ask your sister?
No, they don't. To be fair, they're quite hands off in that way.
Well, hats off to them for being respectful about their daughter's decisions.
Thank you, Veronique and Andrew. But then in terms of how I feel more generally, I think I've always prescribed the idea that womanhood is very much dictated by this maternal urge. And, oh, at a certain point, my ovaries will start pulsating. Because it was something that my friends always used to say, like when they pass like a stroller or whatever, they'd be like, my ovaries are throbbing. Or like, oh my God, if they saw a man with holding a little baby, which we'll come into later, yeah. But I think is problematic, the way we glorify men for doing one cute
sucker.
Thing.
For that.
Yeah, we all are.
I'm a sucker for a DILF and I know that it's deeply problematic.
And they'll be like, oh my God, like my womb is shuddering. And I was like, oh my God, when is my womb going to shudder? When is my like maternal switch going to flip? Like I kept waiting for that literal biological internal feeling. And I have never quite had that. And I felt freakish for not having that. But now the more I have listened and read about other women's experiences, and we'll get onto it in a second, but like Ruby Warrington, for instance, very much debunks the idea that women are inbuilt with a biological maternal instinct.
Yes. So Ruby Warrington actually says that she felt very much the same, as if she had this underlying sense that there must be something wrong with her biologically or hormonally because she didn't want children. Whereas actually this kind of inherent maternalism that you're talking about isn't innate to every woman.
No, and you can be a brilliant mother without ever having had your maternal urge like flip a switch, I guess, in the same way that we're taught to believe it will be. And so I shall just say that like, I am not made up either way. I just don't know.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, I was going to be like, let's just really put our flags down right now.
Is that the saying? Yes. Let's put our eggs on the table. No, our eggs in the
bath. Put your eggs in. No, but that's quite clear as well.
That feels a fertility reference.
Yes, no, that does. Okay, right. Just to be very clear, I would like to ask you, when did you first realise that maybe having children wasn't for you? And perhaps I'm putting words in your mouth there because you don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I would say that I am the jury is out. Like, I can imagine a future where I do have them. And I will also caveat that my partner is listening to this. And so I don't ever want to make binary statements either way, because we are in a constant like dialogue about like what could be right for us. But I feel like there was never a I think it was maybe when we hit 27, when a couple of my university friends became pregnant. One of my male friends had two kids. He was one of the first. And I think then we all thought of that as a bit of an outlier. We're like, ooh, that's young, you know, amazing. So cool to be part of that. But like, that doesn't speak to the majority. Yeah, but then as I've turned 30, more and more friends started to discuss coming off contraception. One of them fell pregnant, another and had a kid. Another one is pregnant. Like, it has now become the norm to have either come off contraception or to be discussing it with your partner or to literally be pregnant. And suddenly it actually happened very quickly, I would say, as soon as we turned 30. I think as soon as the majority of my friendship group started getting engaged or married, that's when the baby chat came in. And it was at that point that I was like, fuck, I need to make a decision. And that
you suddenly felt real pressure.
Yeah, because I was like, oh my God, like, you know, if I don't want them, I need to give my partner the courtesy of a like opting out. Because if that's something that he is like a non-negotiable
for him, yeah.
He needs to be able to make that decision for himself. But I just don't know yet. I think also where I come from it is like, because I'm not anti having children, I'm absolutely not anti it. I think it would be like, if it was a non-negotiable for my partner, I would probably have them so as not to lose my partner. Is that problematic? I don't know.
I think it's so personal. And I think that's really why we even wanted to dig into this in the first place, isn't it? Because there are no right or wrong answers. Like, I think on one side, you could say that you should never compromise on your personal stance around reproduction. But on the other hand, I think as a couple, of course you are a team and you're planning a shared life together. And actually, you need to be on the same page with things. And much of it is a dialogue. It's not cut and dry for everyone. And I think the nuance is exactly what we wanted to explore here, because the reality is that we're sold this kind of narrative that you either definitely want to have children and you're this kind of domestic god or goddess who's going to be naturally nurturing and have this whole kind of, you know, football team of children. It's meant to be this thing that we all intrinsically desire, almost from an evolutionary perspective, but actually we don't. And I think I'm coming to this from a very different perspective insofar as, weirdly, so I'm 32 and most of my friends don't have kids. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, will everyone have children at that age? I would have thought, obviously, yes. And it's really surprised me. And I think there are so many kind of socio-economical, environmental factors at play. I mean, my oldest, closest friends, there's six of us, and none of us have children yet. One of us is married and been with their partner for 10 years. I'm getting married this year. I've been with Marlon for 10 years. I have obviously some single friends too, who are kind of grappling with the added layer of the pressure that's put onto women in terms of your biological clock about actually meeting someone. And that is its own very difficult thing. But I am so surprised that so many people I know who are in these kind of conventional relationships, as we say, are, you know, in good positions in their careers, none of them want to have children at the moment.
It is bloody fascinating. I also do wonder if the fact that there is quite a severe discrepancy between like my friendship group and your friendship group is a kind of hurt psychology, right? As soon as quite a few people make one decision in one group, that really influences the way
everyone
other people
else. Yeah, it's quite like group thinky. I mean, I should preface, I haven't even said what my stance is.
Yes,
and actually, again, this is why I think we love having this conversation with one another, because we're coming from quite different perspectives. Yes. I definitely want to have children. That's been a lifelong certainty for me. Even as a little girl, I was like super maternal. I'm the oldest of four kids. I've always been around babies. I've always felt really confident looking after them. I was a babysitter for years as a teenager. You know, it's very much something that I felt was so natural. So many people would comment, you know, my mum will be like, you're so maternal, you're so amazing with kids. You know, as I was growing up, I don't mean now, obviously. Yeah. I mean,
I can't imagine
my life,
you though.
That was a kind of narrative that was, you will be a great mum. I mean, I've spoken this on air, about this on air before, but for listeners that maybe are just joining us now or haven't heard previous episodes, I even had this perception of myself growing up that I would be a stay-at-home mum. That was my life goal.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was two of your male university friends who was like, Kathleen, what
you
were doing.
It was. It literally was. I can't believe that that belief was kind of interrogated so late in life. I cannot believe that
was
at university and it was two like guy mates just in the pub when we were having a couple of drinks after like a lecture one day or whatever. And I was saying how I wanted to be a stay-at-home mum. And they were like, do you know how depressing that is, Kathleen? You are so capable and you are telling us that you actually just want to raise kids at home. And again, sorry, I really do want to preface that I don't see that as any less. I actually think raising kids is like literally one of the most valuable things that anyone can do. I'm very much in the Gabor Mate school of thought in that the nurturing, education and kind of care of our young people is possibly the most important thing that can be done by a society, because they literally are the future.
Absolutely.
So it's not to minimize those caregivers at all. But it was only having that kind of refracted back to me that I was like, oh yeah, why don't I have bigger ambitions? And I sort of investigated my perception of self as this domestic person.
I guess it's quite an interesting discussion, which I think is kind of probably too big to have right now, but the difference between ambition and maybe a kind of more societal purpose.
Yeah, and I guess for whatever reason, I just hadn't really interrogated that and how much of it is societally driven and how much of it was about what I actually want out of my own life. And the weird thing for me is that at 32 in a 10-year relationship, I actually feel more ambivalent about it than perhaps I ever had.
I know, it's so interesting because when we first met, I don't think we were talking about this for the first few years of a friendship, but I remember maybe like after when you were turning 29, 30, you would often describe yourself as like an earth. I remember the earth mother phrase was something I learned from you because that's how you saw yourself.
In the future. I didn't think that was me then.
In the future.
But I was like, oh, I'll be that like mum.
And I definitely saw that as like, I thought you would have kids by now, genuinely. And so it's been like really interesting to see actually weirdly we have aligned.
More so over the years.
But also I'm only thinking about this now, but so maybe it's too complicated to get in, but I'm suddenly like, hang on, why is career ambition seen as better than stay-at-home mums?
It's such a complicated thing, isn't it?
Because I don't even believe that necessarily it is.
No, and I don't either. And actually, I think part of it for me is that I have become, I suppose, more passionate about my career in the last few years, maybe, in the sense that I'm a freelancer. I know this sounds ridiculous, but there's like a young mum TikToker called Olivia, whose videos I watch quite often. And she literally said that when she got pregnant by surprise, it was her ticket out of corporate life. Like if I was working in an office job that I didn't love, I would probably jump at the opportunity to like take mat leave and have a year off.
I've heard friends say that they literally gone to work somewhere specifically for their mat leave coverage.
Yeah, and I know lots of people take that into account. Lots of my friends now are not moving jobs because you have to think about your mat leave quota and you have to be there for a certain amount of time, and all of those kind of things really do matter. But since I've become a freelancer, it's actually been more financially precarious, of course, than my work was before when I was in a in-house job. And actually, it's just kind of reframed how much I would have to give up, I think. And all of this to say, I definitely still want children. And I know that the biological clock thing that women are kind of taunted with constantly is relevant, but equally,
you can't deny
I'm in a place with my career where I just don't want to step back from it right now. I've actually specifically planned my wedding for this year in part to put off the big kids question.
That's interesting.
And to like get family members and other people to just back off.
And Marlon's, and I mean, I would assume he's on board with that.
Oh yeah, totally on board with it. I mean, he is a freelance like creative as well, so
yes, so interesting, because I actually think I never even thought about having kids when I was younger, so it wasn't even like something that like, oh, I've hated the idea from the start, or oh, I was pro and then I shifted. I just didn't think about it. And I think what happened when I was about 28 was I suddenly realized that the way marriage and children was discussed in the media was incredibly negative. I just remember being like overwhelmed with how suddenly this taboo had been like blown open, and women were writing all these memoirs and fiction about experiences of motherhood, and they were overwhelmingly negative. And I think this is something we need to get into in the second part of this two-parter, is the taboo around regrets around motherhood and being an unnatural mother, I'm putting that in air quotes. There has been so much modern literature about those two things. And that is my starting point as a young woman. Like, yeah. I haven't been around for the beginning of like the 2000s, 90s, where there was no literature about being a mother and everything was idealized and everything was glorified. I am jumping in at the deep end of, oh, let's prize open this taboo and everything is therefore negative. So I personally have just been met with a deluge of very off-putting information. And I am at a point where I am gasping for people to tell me positive stories of motherhood and their birthing experiences or parenthood, because all I'm reading is regret and negativity.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, actually, where I've very much felt that is around the conversations of fertility. So I think I've mentioned this on air before, but I've previously had real fertility anxiety.
You have. I wonder, where do you think, without getting too Freudian again, where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think it's because it was something I've always wanted.
Right.
So I've always really wanted children, and I've always felt that being a mother will be somehow integral to my overall identity in terms of my fulfillment and purpose.
Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I just don't know. I don't know whether it's just how I've always perceived myself, I'd say, as the big sister to younger siblings, as the person that's always been called the natural with all the little cousins.
I also wonder, and again, this is me really psychoanalyzing you, and you may want to cut this out, but coming from divorced parents, maybe you idealize the role of a nuclear family.
Maybe, but I don't even know if it was... I mean, yeah, it is definitely something that I think subconsciously might play a part. Like, I've noticed in my relationship, like, we have definitely tried to create a kind of sense of security, safety and sanctuary with one another. But I don't know if that's where the kind of motherhood thing comes from, because I actually just think it's about my sense of self. As I say, I always knew that motherhood would be a huge part of my overall life's purpose. And so this idea suddenly at 30 or turning 30, when, as you rightly put, the question explodes into your consciousness, I was like, what if I can't? What if I'm putting it off? My big fear was, oh my God, I've been with my life partner, who I knew from really early on was my soulmate. Sorry to be cringe and gross, but I was scared that what if we don't have kids until much later, and then actually we could have had them if we'd had them earlier, and we have serious fertility problems, and it's all my fault for not doing it five years before. That was my irrational thought process at the time. I think, as I said, I had a lot of anxiety, and it was being channeled into that.
Right.
I think in particular, also, I read Magpie by Elizabeth Day right around this time. So in terms of pop culture coverage of fertility issues, I felt like everywhere I turned, there was another article or book or think piece or podcast about women struggling with infertility. And that is absolutely not to minimize the very real struggle that so many women are having. And the data does show, you know, the NHS say 1 in 7 couples now struggle with infertility. So it's a very, very real issue. But I did suddenly feel that I couldn't escape this narrative. And I was terrified that I was going to fall victim to my own, again, internalized narrative that somehow putting off kids is like self-indulgent or something. You know, I was like, what if I regret it? And whereas actually now that I've stepped back from that period of anxiety, I can see that prioritizing my own mental well-being is literally the best thing that I could possibly do before I have kids.
Absolutely. You're so right.
And my career.
I think the media does create false monsters in some ways. And I mean that, like, particularly with cancer, I'm noticing the way national newspapers as well as tabloids will constantly, like almost every day, have like, oh, X interviewed about their experience of, oh, I missed the warning signs and here's the regret. I wish I could, you know, let me impart what I've learned on younger generations, or like my cancer journey, or like, and with The Guardian in particular, it's often like, I'm 30 with this terminal brain tumor, but I've never been happier. Like, 100% is important to platform these stories, and they are very uplifting also in their own way, but it is overwhelming. As someone who is a hypochondriac, I read these cancer stories, I'm like, right, so everyone's going to get cancer at 32.
But then, like, the reality is that 1 in 2 of people are going to get cancer. So this is what I really struggle with how we present the facts as the media.
But often they're like 70, 80, you know.
Yeah, but there's a huge rise in people in their 20s and 30s getting colon cancer at the moment.
Fucking
and like,
hell,
that really scares me, and I see it on TikTok all the time, and I scan through the videos. Well, they think it's lifestyle related, obviously, ultra processed foods, all that kind of thing. But there's been this real uptick in very young people being diagnosed with these cancers that are actually kind of lifestyle based. So there is an element of fear mongering there, but it's also very much based in facts. And this is what I find really difficult around the conversation around fertility, is that on the one hand, a lot of what I look at is very much based in the facts. And the facts are that, yes, you know, as women get older, their fertility does decline. On the flip side, I've read many a piece about how much of that is overplayed.
Yes.
And actually your fertility is only really at a 2% difference from your 20s to your 30s.
So interesting. And I would say this is very much based on anecdotal experiences, but I constantly seem to be meeting women or knowing women that are getting pregnant in their 40s. Recently, as of the last 2 years, it's becoming a common occurrence now for people that I know to be pregnant in their 40s.
Yeah, well, as per the listener message that I read out recently, you know, women do get pregnant in their 40s. Guys, we've said this before, but when it comes to our podcast partners, they really are an authentic recommendation from us to you. We genuinely wouldn't tell you to buy anything that we wouldn't tell our IRL friends to, which is why we are over the moon to be partnering yet again with our favourite adaptogenic coffee brand, London Nootropics.
Yes, and of course, we are armed with a juicy 20% discount code again. So just enter straight up, all one word, no caps, at the checkout at londonnootropics.com. We'll also put it in the show notes. And if you needed just a teeny bit more persuading on how and why adaptogenic coffee will completely change your day, then listen up.
Okay, so adaptogens are fungi and natural plant extracts that clinical studies have proven to have incredible effects on our well-being, from reducing anxiety to boosting energy and your immune system. Els and I have been converts for about a year now. We are obsessed. We drink 1 or 2 of Nootropics' 3 adaptogenic coffee blends every day, depending on whether we're wanting to feel super focused at work, tackle stress, or just go and do some exercise.
Exactly. So I start most mornings with the Mojo blend before heading to the gym. It's made with cordyceps mushroom, known to increase aerobic capacity and oxygen flow. So it naturally boost strength, physical endurance and ATP, which fun fact is our energy molecule. It's actually a way healthier pre-workout than your average pre-workout supplement, which contains way too much caffeine and sweetness.
God, yes, they make me feel so jittery. I do not like those. Nootropics, on the other hand, are top, top stuff, thanks to being so rich in active compounds, a marker of quality and adaptogens, by the way, all of which are listed on the Nootropics website, so you know exactly what you're putting in your body. I must say also that Mojo is perfect for anyone battling with a bit of jet lag.
So true. And if you're worried about adaptogens tasting a little funky, do not worry. These blends, all freshly packaged in gorgeous individual sachets, taste fab. So head to londonnootropics.com and enter the code straight up at the checkout for that 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps. Enjoy, guys. Okay, so I think let's go back to the ONS stats because we need to contextualize why it might be that parents are deciding not to have children at this time.
Or would be parents.
Or would be parents.
Well, Pregnant Then Screwed, which are the leading organization looking at just how difficult it is in our society here in Britain for women to be able to have children and also continue in their careers and actually sort of survive and thrive financially, argue that it is no surprise to us that fertility rates have hit the floor. Procreation has become a luxury item in the UK. Childcare's costs are excruciating, and that's if you can afford a place. Our research found that almost half of parents have been plunged into debt or have had to use savings just to pay their childcare bill. I mean, I genuinely think that the financial aspect is the main reason that my cohort, like my friends, aren't having kids. And it's certainly a main reason for me.
Absolutely, it's the main reason for me. And I think it's important now to just contextualize this with looking at the average salary versus the average cost of childcare. So let's consider that the average UK monthly salary pre-tax, according to 2023 ONS data, is £2,886 per month. That's £34,632 annually. After tax, the net average per month is £2,297 or £27,573 annually. So to contrast, the average amount of money spent on raising a child from birth to 18 in the UK, including housing and childcare costs, is £223,256, according to the latest research from investment platform Money Farm. So monthly, that works out as £1,030.
Yeah, so I think that big picture data can be quite difficult to kind of number crunch, can't it? But stats from the Department of Education actually say that just even having an under two at nursery, the full-time cost for that is close to £300 a week. So that's £14,000 a year. And I've seen that anecdotally from friends of mine that do have children. So a friend of mine who has like the loveliest and most amazing little boy and is so happy being a mum has also had real difficulty, not just with the cost of childcare, but as you touched on, even getting a place. That's a big issue in our society as well. There isn't the infrastructure to actually support working parents. So my friend who's got a 1.5-year-old, she went back to work in October, couldn't literally get a nursery place for her son where she lives. He was like number 250 on the list. She physically couldn't get him into nursery. She therefore had to go with a childminder. That was £75 a day. And I'm not devaluing the work that those childminders and childcare professionals do, because of course they need to be paid properly as well. But when we live in a society that's expecting parents to give up way more than half of their yearly salary just to childcare costs that mean they can actually go to work, we wonder why that doesn't look appealing. I mean, if you have two children under school age, you are literally spending a salary's worth per year on childcare costs, which is why so many women are being priced out of work now as well. If you have more than two children under that age, it's actually sometimes not worth going back to work.
It's interesting because when I think about the way that we're essentially outsourcing childcare, I do think that is quite a Western...
Oh, it's so Western.
A Western... Yeah. Way of living, isn't it? Because I think a lot of other people from around the world will be like, well, don't fucking send your child to childcare then. Stay at home, look after them. And they might have limited sympathy.
Yeah,
for the way
individualistic culture. Yeah,
that you can't have it all. I think a lot of people would think that was ludicrous. And you've got to make a choice, essentially. Do you want to raise your child or do you want to go and be a career person?
I mean, a real issue in the UK in particular is this kind of lack of a village.
It's so interesting to me coming, because I don't come to the idea of parenthood through an instinctual feeling, as I've said. Therefore, I come at it through quite a logical framework. I'm constantly being like, what are the pros? What are the cons? Yeah. What can I afford? What can't I afford? What makes sense? And so I find it really odd, I'm not judging other people's choices. I'm just, for me, I'm finding it hard to get my head around the fact that you would choose to have children, but not be around for most of their...
Well, it's a catch-22 that a lot of mothers are forced into. And I think that's what's so awful. And lots of this kind of mum convo on TikTok speaks to this. I mean, I'm sure you've seen there's been a real rise in a kind of idealization of the stay-at-home mum or the stay-at-home girlfriend or the stay-at-home wife, and this kind of throwback to almost an anti-feminism that's like, hey, I don't care about progress, let me just like fold boxer shorts. I mean, I'm obviously massively like simplifying that, but I do think that a lot of that comes from the fact that some women have realized that actually they would rather be at home with their kids than pay a stranger to do it. I know that it's really difficult for a lot of women, because when babies are one is when they actually start to become a lot more engaging, like they're real little people, I guess, more. And so that's the age that you can start to do fun stuff with them. I know that there's a real resentment around among working mothers who have had to go back to work at precisely the time that motherhood actually becomes enjoyable and then pay through the nose for a stranger to look after their child. Like, it's making a lot of women deeply unhappy.
That's the thing, and that's why I really struggle with this. Like, if you really can't afford to spend enough time with your kid and you have to outsource it and you're going to be unhappy with that choice, like, what is it? What is this urge that makes no rational sense?
Because it's human nature, I guess. And that's maybe where you and I see it differently. Yeah. Like, it's literally biologically like driven, it's evolution. Like, we are literally designed to procreate. And I'm not saying that as some kind of weird religious nut that's like saying that every woman that wants to be child-free by choice is somehow defective. Absolutely not. Of course, each individual human has to take their own life path. And as I've said, I'm in a place now where I'm like feeling like I just don't want to take on that massive responsibility right in this very moment. However, to kind of go down that road, I think is really difficult, because you're essentially saying that only people that can afford it should be able to have kids, which is exactly what the founder of Pregnant and Screwed is saying. Procreation is a luxury. How dare we say that this intrinsic human right of having children should only be afforded to those that feel that they're financially able to? That seems so wrong.
But then also there are two different approaches to that, right? So you could either be really well off and therefore outsource the raising of your children to someone else, or you could be well off enough that you don't need to go back to work, and so you can be a stay-at-home mum.
It's super unusual now, right? Yeah. And that's part of the problem, is that even when we were growing up, single income households were more common, because you could actually provide for a family, let's say of four, on a single income. You cannot do that anymore. And therein lies the issue. You actually really both have to work unless one of you has a really incredible job. It's very unusual to be a stay-at-home mum in this day and age, let's face it.
A YouGov survey from 2020 revealed that the main reasons childless Britons were not going to have children were, I think as we can predict, cost, impact on lifestyle, and overpopulation. Overpopulation is actually one of the reasons my mum has queried why necessarily anyone would want to have children from my generation. As I said, my mum does not put any pressure on me to have kids whatsoever. And in fact, the few times we have talked about it, she has said, why would you bring a child? Why would you want to bring a child into this world? Like, this world's future feels so bleak. And also in terms of climate change, it's not a good idea.
No, and it is scary, because for the first time, I think our generation really can't predict that our grandchildren are even going to be living on a planet that's habitable.
Exactly that.
We can't kind of map the future out like perhaps our grandparents' generation did for us. Absolutely. In that sense, that they had this clear vision of the generations that come and come and come. Whereas for us, it's like the whole planet could be burning. I mean, so many celebrities have said that that's their main reason. Miley Cyrus says that that's her main reason for not having children. So Miley has said previously in a 2019 Elle magazine interview, we're getting handed a piece of shit planet and I refuse to hand that down to my child. Until I feel like my kid would live on Earth with fish in the water, I'm not bringing another person in to deal with that. And I think that really does speak to this generational anxiety, doesn't it?
Particularly Gen Z, I think with my sister's generation in particular, there is a sense of, I am already struggling so much as it is. How could I possibly bring another person into this world? Yeah.
I mean, Mo Gordat, who is the chief AI officer of Stephen Butler's company, Fight Story, but I think in a way that's actually minimizing what he does. Yeah, formerly of Google X. He is honestly the most incredible person. I've definitely talked about him on the podcast before. He has a podcast called Slow Mo. His episode with Elizabeth Day in How to Fail literally changed my complete worldview, completely changed my own perspective on anxiety as being a kind of inbuilt survival instinct and understanding it as something natural to manage, and that we have a negativity bias, all those things. He really, really helped me really understand my own mind. I consider him to be one of the brightest minds that we have in society. And he specifically said on the rise of AI recently, if you're thinking about having kids, put it on pause. You need to see what happens here.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is fucking
from someone like
chilling.
That.
That's chilling.
And he has kids.
Yeah, AI. I hadn't even thought about that. I mean, I was thinking of David Attenborough saying all our environmental problems become easier to solve with fewer people. I mean, that is just stating the bleeding obvious, really. But I mean,
But then on the flip side, some of the concern for the ONS now, like we've touched on, is that we do need babies to be born because they will be the people in the future that pay the taxes for healthcare. They'll be the people looking after us in our old age. They'll be the doctors and the nurses and the care workers. So weirdly, we have this like broader societal responsibility.
We have a major aging population problem is what we have.
But then I do really want to be careful around that argument because I feel like it's such an Elon Musk. Like I'm sure you saw Elon Musk said that we're, you know, that population collapse due to low birth rates is a much bigger risk to civilization than global warming. There's something about that that doesn't sit right with me because I feel like the onus is on women to have to sort that out. And there's this, particularly on the internet with the kind of red pillar world, there's a responsibility on women to go back to the domestic sphere and that we're failing humanity if we don't actually take this burden on of furthering the human race instead of getting on with our lives and what makes us happy and our careers and fulfillment and whatever else comes with that.
There's interesting because there are statisticians who believe that right now we're seeing lower fertility rates coinciding with rich countries' gender equality.
And yes.
There's a huge correlation between gender equality
and
low fertility rates. But there are some statisticians who believe that there will be a U-turn, which is that countries that put in practice very highly feminist incentives, i.e. probably like, you know, great paternity leave or financial support for women that have children, great career support, that eventually those countries will have the highest fertility rates because women will feel most supported and therefore most comfortable in having children again.
See, I totally agree with that. And I think that's the big problem in British society, the elephant in the room, as it were, that no one's looking at, which is like, oh, why do none of you not want to have kids? Just get on with it. It's like because you've created conditions that make it feel impossible, actually.
I would actually say that that is the reason for me feeling trepidation. It's the idea that I would have to give up my career whilst my partner was able to continue. It's the idea that my body will be like maimed and ripped open whilst his will remain completely intact. It's the fact that I might get postnatal depression and he won't. Like, it is completely tied up in the fact that I feel like the playing field is completely uneven.
Yeah, and I think so much of the public conversation speaks to this. Have you seen the trend on TikTok about let's have a baby? And it's like a woman thinking about all the big picture ramifications of having a child, as you've just touched on, whether that's your career, your body, your mental health, your finances. And yet men are like, let's have a baby. It's yeah. Like, yeah, it's all right for you, mate. And I think Olive by Emma Gannon, the novel about living a child-free life by choice, is so pertinent here. So guys, if you haven't listened to our episode with Emma Gannon, do go back and listen to it because it's all about embracing a child-free life by choice. And I guess navigating the actual decision, which is very much the space that you're in, as you've said. And Olive, the titular character of the book, is navigating it because she's 30. Her long-term partner has actually said he does definitely want kids. She's really realized in this moment that perhaps she doesn't. And so actually they split up because she doesn't want to hold him back from realizing a life goal of his own. And she's got a whole friendship group. Again, one of the friends is one of these women that's never really mentioned even wanting to have kids. And then suddenly they're all very much, you know, got babies on the brain. The book reckons with this idea that you can't just do it for a man, but equally you have to respect how they feel too about wanting kids. It's so complicated.
It's so complicated. And actually, talking of that partner relationship, I actually do getting a bit vulnerable here. One of the reasons why I'm really scared to have kids is the idea that I've been told repeatedly now in the last few years that your relationship will be rocked to its very foundations and may not recover. And as Nora Ephron said in Heartburn, her 1983 book, she said, I remember thinking that no one had ever told me how much I would love my child. Now, of course, I realise something else no one tells you, that a child is a grenade. When you have a baby, you set off an explosion in your marriage. And when the dust settles, your marriage is different from what it was. And I think my worry is that it will never recover because we see divorce rates are rising.
Well, they're actually at the lowest level, ironically.
Oh, because of the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, yeah, it shows how much
the economic situation
dictates people's life choices. No one's getting divorced because they can't afford it.
Yeah, that's actually so true. Okay, before the cost of living crisis, they were rising. And I just am constantly told left, right and center that like it genuinely ruins relationships.
I mean, relationships do deteriorate, but I would say a lot of that is about the financial pressure. So a friend of mine who is a mother has said to me, she has an incredibly strong relationship with her partner. But the one thing they row about is finances because they are now in an incredibly precarious position where every month they're trying to make ends meet. They both have good jobs, but because they're spending, as I said, fucking 14,000 a year on childcare, they are always playing catch up. And that creates tension. I would just have to give up so much that at the moment it just doesn't look appealing. That's it for me. I would be giving up all of the nice things that I can do. I would not be able to go on holiday. I wouldn't be able to go out for dinner with my friends. I wouldn't be able, and this is outside of the actual lifestyle curtailments that come with being responsible for another human. I'm literally just talking about the financial here. My lifestyle would drastically change having to take on those costs. And I know it sounds so selfish and so like capitalistically mad, but it just doesn't look that attractive, does it, when you're thinking about it? Els, what I really actually want to know is how you sleep at night.
What a chilling question, Cathers. But actually, I do sleep quite well. Thank you for asking. So long as I don't look at screens before bed and so long as I have my earplugs, because I live on a main road, so the traffic is deafening all night.
And would it be wildly presumptuous of me, perchance, to assume that those earplugs are from our Huns at Flare Audio?
Well, no, funnily enough, they are, Cathers.
Okay, so guys, as we all know, maintaining good sleep health is vital for your overall well-being, and Flare Audio sleep earplugs are a game changer for light sleepers. They're tiny, unobtrusive, and designed with a super soft memory foam ball that molds the shape of your ear. So, unlike most other earplugs, they never ever fall out.
They have countless five-star reviews from customers suffering with insomnia, ADHD, extreme sound sensitivities, and more. Plus, sleeps fit into any and all ear sizes. They come with replacement tips, and they start from just £4.95 at flareaudio.com.
A steal. So for more tips on sleep health, we also really recommend Natalie Pennicote-Collier's excellent book, Sleep Reset. Natalie is a clinical sleep therapist who was dubbed the insomnia expert by the Sunday Times. Trini Woodall's a fan, and she's a Flare partner. So because Natalie herself and her teenage children are neurodiverse, teaching young adults CBTI to help with their insomnia is a very personal mission of hers.
What a good mission. Also, what's good is her mantra, which is a good night's sleep actually starts each morning.
Thank you so much to Flare.
Picking up what you said a while earlier, how you said you always felt an innate sense that you would be a good mother.
Yes.
And I think this is in particular what freaks me out, is that what I've learned from reading other women's experiences is that motherhood is so unpredictable. You could go into motherhood thinking that you're going to be the best mother in the world. But if you have a child with behavioral issues, or if your circumstances change, you cannot predict that you could be a good mother. I mean, you can try your best, but like on paper, that can change. And I think that I found that, and we'll go on to it into our next episode when we tackle the idea of taboo when it comes to motherhood and regret in women and the sense of unnatural motherhood. I say that in air quotes. But when I went on a Facebook group called Why I Regret Having Children, of which there are 72,000 members,
yikes.
And a lot of them were talking about how they went into parenthood, it was men and women, with the best intentions. They desperately wanted children, but because of the circumstance of their child maybe having, as I say, but severe behavioural issues or circumstantial issues, that has simply not been able to
be realised.
That has simply not been realised. It's impossible to realise. And that has plunged them into a great sense of shame and guilt and depression.
I bet. I mean, on the flip side, just to play devil's advocate, because we are trying to have a well-rounded
sides,
debate.
Absolutely.
There was a stunning excerpt from a book run in the New Yorker recently by Leslie Jameson, and it was called The Birth of My Daughter, The Death of My Marriage. Really, really recommend that piece. It is so beautifully written, and it's very much about how you just reframe everything in your life, perhaps post-kids. So it doesn't necessarily say that your relationship is in tatters because of the pressure of having a child, more so that you just look at everything through a new lens. Mm-hmm. And actually her marriage wasn't working out anyway. And it took having a child to really see that.
That sounds fascinating. I need to read that.
It's beautiful. It's one of those pieces of writing that's really like evocative and quite flowery, and I mean that in the best way. I don't know how I'm saying flowery, but you know I mean, like
ornate.
That's it. You'll love it. Basically, it's okay. A real piece of writing that I know that you'll adore.
I did actually see that.
Actual brilliance.
I'm excited to read that. So I want to go back to gender equality, because I find South Korea a very interesting case study when we look at the correlation between gender equality and fertility rate. So South Korea has the world's lowest fertility rate, and yet it's had probably the most money of any country in the world pumped into pronatal policies. So it's become a state of national emergency, the fertility rate, and the government has so far invested over $200 billion. So to go back to the stats, the average number of births per woman in South Korea in 1970 was 4.53. And by 2022, it had gone down to 0.78.
Sorry to interrupt you. I was going to ask, what do they attribute this to?
So from looking at the graphs, I would say that is directly related to the women's movement. So The biggest fall was between 1979 and 1984 when it halved, and this coincided with the women's movement in South Korea heavily gaining traction. In 1977, the Institute of Women's Research was created at South Korea's first university for women. In 1985, there was a national women's rally. Then in 1986, spurred by the rape and torture of female labor organizer Kwon In-suk by the hands of police in Bishon, women rallied together to form the Korean Women's Association United. And so by 1987, women made up 55% of South Korea's paid workforce, which I think is probably the most crucial stat. Like, essentially, what was a super patriarchal society became a lot more even, and a lot more women were being in the workforce and therefore couldn't have children.
So in a strange way, I actually think that the massive reduction of fertility, as we're saying, yeah, in terms of people actually having children, can be read as a positive, because actually the fact that women are for the first time questioning their role, not absolutely just in society, but in their own lives, is really, really empowering. Actually, to know that you don't have to have children just because society dictates that you should, I think is a brilliant thing. And I think female empowerment in education can only be read as a positive. Like, yes, less people might have children, but surely if women are living happier, more fulfilled lives, then that can only be a positive. I mean, we've talked about this on air before, but there's the high heel effect. I think, yes, it's Chris Williamson, who's that strange Love Islander turned now massive podcaster, who, fun fact, is I think the most successful person to have ever come off Love Island, because he's now considered this like upper echelon speaker.
Yeah.
He talks about the high heel effect, which basically says that the reason that there are so many amazing eligible women and not enough men is because of this shift in society that has seen women become educated, empowered, confident. And it means that women now don't want to like literally look down. That's why it's called the high heel effect, because they're also talking about the height difference, this thing that women don't love to date men shorter than them. Really sums up this idea that women don't feel that they should have to like settle.
And I think what we should talk about soon is, you know, the rise of solo parenting. And a lot of my friends, for instance, are talking about egg freezing and raising kids with other friends. And
yeah, and I mean, I actually think that the pets as kids thing is definitely real. Look at us,
yes,
pet moms. I'm sure I'm channeling quite a lot of my maternal energy into my cat and dog. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but I genuinely do think I am. Like, sometimes my brother will laugh at me when I'm holding the dog. He's like, you need to have kids, you do.
Do you know what? Even though I've been going on and on about how I don't necessarily think kids are for me, yeah, the way I am with my cat, I sometimes catch myself. I'm like, if this
you
was
are
a
maternal
kid, I would be mollycoddling it to like buggery. Like, even my sister, I know, sorry. Even when my sister goes home after spending an evening at my flat, I will like send me exactly your location in the Uber, like tell me when you get home, or like ring her. Like, I get very concerned.
Yeah, I think you're more maternal than you think you are. And yeah, I want to be really careful saying that, because I've actually been that person that has parroted the thoroughly annoying viewpoint that so many people in the child-free movement feel, which is, oh, you'll change your mind. I remember saying that to you years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Now I know, having actually done the research, thought about it a bit more, whatever, how deeply problematic and belittling and just patently untrue that is. I actually have no idea if you'll change your mind. It's literally not for me to say. How dare I?
Well, my mind isn't even made up either way.
Yeah, how dare I have made the assumption that suddenly you would want kids when you were 35? It's really, really not for me, yes, to say. I've definitely learned that. But my societal programming was telling me, oh, you're just not sure yet, but you actually are maternal.
Well, that is what Is has actually said is his favourite thing about me, is that I'm deeply... When he's ill, for instance, I can't help but like kind of mother him.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a whole other oh, well, thing, isn't oh my it? God. How men want women that mother them. That's
I know.
Oh, the killer fish. Maybe, not him specifically, but just generally all men want a woman that mothers them. It's interesting to hear the kind of male perspective on this, isn't it? Because we were out for dinner literally last week with a partner of the podcast who's a 33-year-old man.
Yes.
And he said that he very much feels the same as we do. So I know that it's not just something that's coming from women, because women have the additional pressure of the division of labor around the household being so unequal. It's clearly still something that's frightening men.
It's interesting because, again, this is me speaking on huge generalizations and I don't know how men feel, but if women are maybe led by this alleged maternal instinct, what is it men are led by? The idea of keeping their family name and a lineage.
So I heard this really interesting perspective recently on a podcast. I think it was Alain de Botton, and I think I might have even mentioned it on air, but he talks about the kind of inbuilt evolutionary side of jealousy. And he says that women's worst fear is that a man is going to run off and leave them to raise their kids on their own. So the most important thing when you're looking for a partner is someone that's stable, reliable, great father, blah, blah, blah. He says that for men, and obviously I'm talking about heteronormative dynamics here, the biggest fear for a man is that the woman is secretly pregnant by someone else, so that you're raising someone else's kids.
Oh, wow.
That's why men are so jealous. And that's why women get jealous about emotional affairs, because they actually want the safety of a familial structure.
Yeah.
But men get super jealous sexually.
Interesting.
Because their worst fear is to be raising the child of another man, because it's deeply inbuilt to our evolutionary psychology that they want, that we all want to like further the species.
I also have read that men will get jealous of the baby.
They do. Well, this is a really big thing, and it's something that I have thought about. I know lots of kind of progressive parents are able to share childcare and it's fine, but there's definitely a sense in the literature, at least around motherhood, that men can feel a little bit alienated by the presence of this other being. And actually, Leslie Jamieson, who I just mentioned, who wrote the excerpt in The New Yorker on the birth of my daughter, the death of my marriage, touches on this. Her husband felt totally isolated. He wasn't part of the world that they were in anymore.
I mean, not to get too like explicit, but you are literally, your body that was once for like the sexual pleasure of your relationship and your partner is now very much in its own world with the baby and the mother, in terms of literally the baby being like latched onto
dominating
the breast.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, the breast, I think, until a mother gives birth, is very much a sexual part of a woman's body. And I think that must be quite weird.
One of Emily Ratajkowski's essays is on this, isn't it? In her My Body book. It is. It's about the reframing of like the boob, essentially.
I mean, I actually find that one of the most difficult things to get my head around is the idea of breasts being suddenly completely like rerouted. Like, can you ever go back to the way they were?
I think because I'm the oldest child, I saw my mom breastfeed both my brothers, and it's always been like a really natural thing to me. I know that sounds
Which is how it should be, I think.
Yeah.
But I am still,
I've never seen the boobs as primarily sexual, because as a young child, before I even understood sexuality, I understood the boob as like feeding babies.
Which is, again, why breastfeeding should be normalized to be done in public, because I wish I had seen more of that in public. In fact, instead, I remember as a child, I remember women being like scurried away with like cloths over their shoulders to hide it. It was seen as such a private activity.
I
didn't ever saw a woman breastfeeding in
public.
You
could get in trouble literally in public. Men would shame you for doing it. Other women would shame you. It was a really, I think it even still is, to be honest, a pretty politicized issue. I'm sure that mothers listening will be able to let us know exactly what that experience is like. It's definitely not suddenly like, oh, everyone in society just accepts it.
Well, I still find it, you know, it's still shocking to me, and I don't mean that in a negative way, I just mean I am unused to seeing this on Instagram when women will post breastfeeding pictures, because it's a bit of a movement, isn't it, on Instagram in particular, to show your natural breastfeeding.
I mean, even the politicization of breastfeeding is something that puts me off from wanting a baby tomorrow, if you know what I mean. Even though I'm someone that has a lifelong dream and goal of being a mother, my God, the difficulties. I think the breastfeeding piece encapsulates just how thorny being a mother is, because you can't do wrong for doing right. You've always got people on your back. There's the mum police. You know, some people think you should do this. We've talked about Shirin KL's piece about breastfeeding.
I was just thinking about this.
Really important piece, I think.
Well, I would actually say that it was pieces like this, even though I'm so glad that they exist, and they must exist, and they're so necessary. But Shirin Carly's piece called,
I felt rage. I had traded my sanity for milk. What happened when I breastfed despite the pain? And it was for The Guardian, and it was published in January.
Oh, yes, that's it. And I remember reading that, and the graphic description of the fact that her nipples were literally lacerated and full of pus and bleeding because her baby wouldn't latch. And I think it had something to do with the tongue, which you know more about. Tongue tie. So the baby's tongue was making it almost impossible to breastfeed in a way that didn't maim the breast. And the midwives, the female midwives, were essentially telling her, no, you've got to keep going because it's the most natural thing and the best thing for your baby. And she became so depressed and associated her baby with pain. And there's no way that once you associate your baby with pain, that can't have horrible like repercussions mentally. And I remember there's an I think it's maybe the way she opens the piece where she describes her husband like cradling, like bringing the baby over to her, and it's like breastfeeding time, and she's like literally like, oh my god, this is like the worst image ever. Like I'm dreading these two people coming towards me at all these various points during the day because I know how much pain I'm about to be in.
What's fascinating about that piece though is that it encapsulates this weird dichotomy that's constantly going on, because she says all this, and then by the end of the piece, she's like, I now love breastfeeding.
Yes, it's a very nuanced piece, but I think what is very clear in the piece is something we've talked about a lot, is medical misogyny towards
women.
Definitely,
and I think that's such a huge issue with mothers.
Yeah, not believing women's pain or feeling that women should suck it up. And actually, I listened to a very good essay for Tortoise. I think it was originally written, but the author, Catherine Nixie, also read it out. So you can listen to it in all podcast apps. And she talks about the insane pain that mothers often feel during birth, that they are forced or feel pressure to pretend doesn't exist. So she says, you'd swear if you stubbed your toe, if someone tore off your toe, an injury closer to the tearing of childbirth, you'd surely have something to say about it. To give you an idea of what must happen to your flesh, the average cervix before birth is narrower than the word cervix when written in this font. The average baby's head, by contrast, is 35 centimetres in circumference. You can see that something is going to have to give, and it isn't the baby. But I do think that there is this sense, as Catherine says in the essay, that you're not, that it's kind of unnatural to talk about your pain, and it's selfish because you're kind of giving greater importance to your pain as a mother than the beautiful natural event of your baby giving birth.
See, I wonder if that portrayal is just a reflection of the actual hormonal experience. So friends of mine that have had babies have said to me that of course it was literally the most horrific experience ever going through labor. And one friend told me how she and her partner were saying, we're never doing this again, we're never doing this again, when she was about to give birth to their first child. But within 2 minutes of him being born, they were like, right, let's plan the next. Because you genuinely are programmed, particularly as a woman, to forget that pain, because otherwise you'd never do it again. That's how the human brain works, because you wouldn't have any more kids if you constantly remembered the pain of childbirth.
That's a good point.
If that's less sanitizing it and making it more palatable for others and actually representative of the mother experience.
I was also reading some articles that the way you feel pain versus pleasure during childbirth is so dependent on the circumstance you're in. So apparently some women can have quite orgasmic births, and you can like masturbate during birth.
Yeah, there's a whole school of thought around that, the pain pleasure complex. And apparently the baby experiences that when they come through the birth canal, it's like pain and pleasure. But hypnobirthing is a really big thing now. I'm definitely going to do that personally.
Really?
Yeah, 100%, because hypnobirthing is a way to really bring the partner into it as well.
Yes.
And you do lots of breathing techniques and you plan in advance and you kind of know what you're doing and it becomes less stressful. I mean, I'm saying all of that having absolutely not given birth or done hypnobirthing, but I would like to do that. And I know that that's like an aim for a lot of mothers that I know. And it's the kind of like, it's what Deliciously Ella did. It's what Megan Grubb did. I mean, I'm throwing out random like influencery names here, but just...
Yeah, see, I think maybe me researching more of that would probably make me feel a lot more positive towards the birthing experience, because all I have is like images of women's vaginas being torn through their fucking anuses and like stitches and epidurals. And there's Deborah Pasquili-Bonaro, who is a doula and co-author of Orgasmic Birth, said that much of the pain that women experience during childbirth is very much as a result of the way they're treated in hospitals. Many hospitals use the same room for a sick person as a person giving birth, and that environment actually creates more pain. People don't feel safe, they don't feel respected, and their hormones don't flow. The hormones of conception and orgasm are exactly the same hormones, God, and they need to flow in labor. So if you look in the conditions of our current hospitals, how many people would have great orgasms in them? So we use synthetic oxytocin and medications and drugs, and we're making labor more painful as a result.
One of the most powerful pop culture presentations of birth trauma that I've seen is in Fleischman Is in Trouble.
Yes, I haven't seen the TV show.
Oh my God, I thought you had. So Claire Danes' character obviously undergoes some serious medical misogyny and is really kind of abused in a way by the doctor who performs a procedure of moving the baby in her stomach without her wanting him to. That really made me realize how impactful birth trauma can be, because you see her mental health massively deteriorate over years after that. And that's the big trigger. And I think we just don't speak about this enough. I think it's so important and rarely considered, the maternal death rates, particularly among Black mothers.
I mean, yes, we've talked about medical misogyny when it comes to just not believing women's pain. But as you say, it's vital to say that I think the maternal death rate was 3 times higher for women from Black or minority ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah, compared to white women in 2020 to 2022. So it's a really, really serious issue. And I think it speaks to the prejudice of the medical community, as we've said, and the fact that every woman isn't treated the same. And actually, you can have a profoundly traumatic experience or a profoundly positive experience. And that's not about you and the mother you are, or the father you are, or the person you are.
Yes. I think one thing for me that I've just found really interesting, I only have a few friends that have given birth, as I've said, but I wouldn't say that they have been that open with what happened to them during their birth, which is fine. It's up to them.
Well, it's probably societal as well, that you don't speak about it.
Exactly. And I also have close family female friends who are older, who have struggled with postnatal depression, but rare, like other than saying that they had depression. In fact, it was always the men in the family that would say, oh, they've struggled with postnatal depression, but the women would never say that. Like they would almost like gloss over it. It was really, I remember growing up and being like, oh, what is like postnatal depression and why are the women and the older women in my family like really kind of closed up on it? And I do think Keira Knightley touches on this all in the Weaker Sex essay in Feminists Don't Wear Pink by Scarlett Curtis, where she talks about, again, as I just said, this pressure on women to just act like birthing is the most beautiful, perfect experience in the world, and that suffering should be private and therefore hidden and shameful. And it opens with, my vagina split, you came out with your eyes open, arms up in the air, screaming, they put you onto me covered in blood, vernix, your head misshapen from the birth canal, pulsating, gasping, screaming. And then she goes on to talk specifically about Kate Middleton, who gave birth the day after Keira gave birth on the 2nd of May 2015. And do you remember there was all those pictures of Keira, of Kate Middleton out on the hospital steps.
Yeah, outside the hospital the day after she'd given birth, and everyone was like, what the fuck? How dare you make her do that? And then people thought Meghan Markle was out of order because she didn't do it, just having given birth.
Exactly. And Keira Knightley's essay is quite judgmental of Kate. She says, hide our pain, our body splitting, our breasts leaking, our hormones raging. Look beautiful, look stylish, don't show your battleground, Kate. 7 hours after your fight with life and death, 7 hours after your body breaks open and bloody screaming life comes out, don't show, don't tell. Stand there with your girl and be shot by a pack of male photographers. Kathas, have I told you that one of my resolutions this year is to be more spontaneous?
Do you know what, you haven't, but I definitely approve of that.
Well, I am glad, babe, because I'm sick to the back teeth, let me tell you, about creating doodle poll after doodle poll just to see my friends.
I hear you. Diary Tetris is one of the most annoying things about being a grown-up with a mobile phone.
Literally. However, as we both know, getting a reservation in London in particular is a nightmare.
Comes a close second.
Exactly. But there is an app that is really helping with that issue. Amble, A-M-B-L. Do you want to hear about it, babe?
I do. This definitely sounds intriguing. Tell me more.
So it's a London reservations app that saves so much time by reversing the way we discover and book bars and restaurants. The venues discover you.
Ooh, I love that. So only those with availability actually show up on the app.
Exactly. And the best thing about Amble is that you can input all these great filters, which means you can really curate what kind of restaurants that you want to come up. So you can choose on the vibe, whether it's a date night or a girl's dinner. You can choose whether you want live music, particular cuisine. You can set a certain price range. And then Amble shows you all the venues that meet your criteria and you can instantly book the venue that you want.
Okay, this sounds brilliant. It's essentially like having your own personal pocket concierge.
Exactly, and I've wanted one of those for years.
We love the bougie life.
We do, and it's such an effortless way to unlock London's hidden reservations by providing real-time availability. Usually I get so frustrated between different apps and websites to see what's available last minute and working out whether it suits what I want.
Oh, so annoying.
Literally, so this saves so much time.
Okay, that is an essential app for all of our fellow food and drink obsessives here in the capital. I am sold.
Yay! Head to the App Store and download Amble, that's spelled A-M-B-L, today. Thank you so much to our partner Amble.
See, on the flip side, I would say that there has been an influx of negative portrayals of motherhood online of late. I mean, some might argue that they're realistic, but I think there's been this real uptick in traumatic birth stories, in nighttime feeding routine vlogs, you know, the mum police. There's this real sea change in women being able to speak honestly about these potentially traumatic experiences and us holding space as a society for mums to be able to do that. I mean, TikTok in particular, I think, is a space where mums can express how they really feel about what they've been going through. And I think that's amazing. But I do also think that that has fed into women feeling scared about being mothers. So Stylist ran a cover piece recently titled, Is Motherhood Really That Bad? I found the comments section on this piece fascinating. Because while Stylist is, of course, trying to posit that this online or social media projection of motherhood, so motherhood content, that's what's scaring women from having babies. Actually, in the comments, you look and you see it's these lifestyle factors that we've touched on. And they say that this story is incredibly simplistic and it's not taking into account the financial aspect that we have a society that makes it incredibly difficult for women to raise children. So one of the first comments, even, for example, is scared. I'm not scared. I just don't want to. Although the stories I hear of costs of childcare are genuinely scary. But I found it really interesting seeing the debate. One comment that really stuck with me that annoyingly I actually can't find right now while I'm trying to scroll through it was from Manon, who was a contestant on the Great British Bake Off a few years ago. And she commented basically saying that this is like such an extension of like late stage capitalism. This idea that a child is almost like a product that we could or couldn't have isn't actually allowing for the otherworldly magic of being a parent. And it's like reducing it down to a kind of economic decision. And it's so much more than that. And actually, I think there was a really interesting comment as well from Ashley Louise James, who is a well-known presenter and broadcaster who has children. She commented, I think this is a really poor use of language. Mothers are really struggling because of the systems that make it hard for us. Poor maternity and postnatal care, leaving people traumatized or struggling. The most expensive childcare in the world, forcing women who want to work out of work, or forcing people to be in single income houses because they can't afford to work. It's not about mums being negative, but I also think it's important things aren't sugar coated and mums aren't brushed off as being negative. Maybe then things will improve for future mums. And equally, I think motherhood doesn't have to be for everyone, and that's the beauty of choice. Being child free should be seen as valid. This isn't for everyone, and that's okay. I thought that was really,
I think that's really
prescient. Yeah, because actually, in a way, these kind of stories, like, is motherhood really that bad because women are making it look bad online, is again negating responsibility from society at large, and it's putting it back, right back, the onus onto women again. Yeah. Oh, well, if we didn't showcase it in a negative way, maybe other people wouldn't be scared. You know, it's just like a very binarized argument.
So true.
So I do think, while we talk about the reasons why people may or may not have children, we really should, on that note, talk about the health reasons that some people might choose not to have children. Because I really think that the child-free choice movement doesn't allow for those who, as you've touched on, aren't sure, or those that might not want to be a mother for different reasons rather than ideological. So on the mental health side, you obviously have to factor in this idea that people don't want to repeat generational trauma. Baby Queen, the musician, touched on this with us in our episode. So if you want to hear her talk about that, do go back and listen
and
to it.
And of course, Sorrow's Bliss.
Exactly, is That's very much about that.
All about a woman who desperately really does want to be a mother, but doesn't go through with it because she feels that she will be a bad mother because of her mental health, and she doesn't want to pass that on to her child, or she feels that her mental health means that she will be an unnatural mother, I guess.
So I think the mental health piece is really important, but also, as a listener has raised to us, you know, your physical health does actually come into it too. And I think it's incredibly frustrating for women who are in that space because no one ever acknowledges that. So a lovely listener of ours wrote in relation to this episode. I actually had the crossroads recently at 26 of whether to go ahead with motherhood with chronic kidney failure. I was told that it's only going to get harder, so I needed to be doing it right away if I was going to be doing it. But I had to decide against it in the end because it was just too high risk for me to be comfortable with, risk both to myself and the hypothetical baby. I can find the fertility combo very binary. Either you can or can't have kids. When actually a lot of women, especially chronically ill honeys, is so much more willy. Like you're just weighing up a heap of risks on top of a standard pregnancy decision. I tend to tell people that I can't have children because it's easier than explaining the complexity and dangers of pregnancy with kidney failure. Either way, I am sick to death of family saying, you're next, whenever I hold my cousins and nieces. I have good days and bad days, understanding I'll never be a mum, but I'm coming around to the glam auntie lifestyle we'll have to do and making peace with that. Lots of love to you both. Love the pod. To add, it's not even just pregnancy, but weighing up what kind of mother you'll be when you have health conditions. I was worried about being too poorly and too tired to handle the absolute energy-sucking hurricane of motherhood.
I so empathise with that. I mean, who wouldn't? But I mean, yeah.
I just don't think that's spoken about enough. Society projects this idea that choosing whether or not to have children is, as we've said, almost a selfish decision that you make based on your own personal goals for your life.
Or your life.
Your career. Yeah, your lifestyle. Choice. Not your health. Actually, we rarely consider those women.
So true. Maybe we'll discuss this more in episode 2, but there is something really, really toxic with the idea of womanhood and motherhood being bound up in the same thing, and that you are not a real woman or you are not fulfilling your potential as a woman if you do not have children.
Yeah.
And actually, as well as health, I think we should talk about the pandemic skip and the effect, the pressure that that's had on people.
That is so pertinent at the moment, I think. We have all sort of frozen in age.
Absolutely. I think there is so much to be said of the fact that so many women in their late 20s were forced to move back in with their parents, which is a hugely infantilizing situation to be in. It is really difficult to then see yourself as someone who could flip that and be parents.
Well, also, there's the women that weren't in relationships that maybe really want children, had 2 years of their lives put on hold in terms of meeting someone.
Absolutely.
There was so much fertility anxiety for so many people. And I think obviously still is. We're feeling the ramifications of that now. People weren't able to do anything in these vital years, as it were. And women are already made to feel so pressurized about this as it is. The anxiety is unreal.
That's the thing. I think we often talk about single women who are maybe healthy as having this choice, but no, circumstance plays a huge part in it. You may have the money, you may be completely physically healthy, but if you haven't met the right person, that is a circumstantial setback.
And yes, Ruby Warrington, who, as you've mentioned, is one of the kind of leaders of this child-free movement. She wrote the book Women Without Kids. She went onto the podcast We Can Do Hard Things and spoke about the power of a child-free life, saying that actually, statistically, the largest portion of women without kids are child-free by circumstance, not by choice. So career, partner, it's not as cut and dry as choice for Ruby. It's not this affirmative no that she had. Actually, for a lot of women, it is this circumstance. And I think Camille Cherarie touches on that in her piece that we brought up recently for Vogue that was really heart-wrenching and really important, I think, which was about having more conversations about infertility with friends and family. She is in the situation that she is with struggling with IVF at the moment, she argues in her piece, because she wasn't ever thinking about her fertility prior to meeting the one. She was wholly focused on meeting the one, again, air quotes here. And that kind of set everything back for her.
Of course. And then there's all these things that we probably can't even do justice to. But I know someone who met the one, but then he very tragically died all of a sudden. Like, you just cannot predict. Like, this is what the unpredictability of motherhood is, something that I don't think is necessarily
accounted for.
I totally agree. Simply cannot predict what awful or beautiful things will happen in life.
And I do think the pandemic skip is relevant to a lot of my friends. As I say, these are 32 and 33 year olds that I'd have definitely would have assumed would be having kids by now. Quite a lot of them are engaged. I mean, my friends aren't wildly traditional. Like, I wouldn't say that many of my friends are actually even married. I'm one of the only ones that's going to be married after this year. So it's definitely not like a kind of friendship group culture thing. But I do really believe that the pandemic skip has made everyone feel more young than they actually are.
Yeah.
Like, no one wants to let the fun die. I mean, that's a huge generalization. And what I will say about that, actually, and I really want to caveat this now, is my friends that have had babies are exactly the people that they were before. So people talk about their friends almost feeling like completely different people. My friends with kids, they're absolutely part of all of our friendship activities in exactly the same way they were before. Okay, yeah, they might not stay out crazy late, but like the bubs come to Christmas dinner, they'll come on our girls and
same with
boyfriend holidays.
Yeah,
it's not like they're suddenly like excluded from the group because they're parents. We just make it work and it's great and it's really not a big deal.
I have a friend of friend, and I'm sure this would actually probably prompt judgment from some really like shamey people about like the right or wrong way to have a kid, but I know a girl who brings her baby like to festivals and did from like literally like couple months after giving birth.
I think that's actually kind of great. Yeah. That's to me as like parents'
as long
goals.
As they're safe.
I'm not saying that babies have to be at festivals. I probably personally wouldn't be asked to take a baby to a festival just because I'm lazy and I can't be bothered with even the idea of that. It makes me tired. But hats off to those parents that are doing that. I think those parents that are living like a normal life with kids, that to me is so aspirational.
Yes. When I see those dads pushing the little wheelbarrows with the earplugs on their kids.
To go back though to the pandemic skip, we got a really interesting insight from a listener that I would love to share with everyone, because she fed back on our chat on aging. I think it's really relevant here. She said, I genuinely think the pandemic Zoom and social media filters have meant that we don't know what real faces look like. I also think this combination has played a massive role in millennial women's perceptions on motherhood and fertility, the warping of milestones. Such a good point.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good point. Because if we are constantly tweaking our faces to look younger, how could we possibly feel old enough to have kids?
Yeah. There's this joke that we've laughed about before, but genuinely, I've seen memes about this and I'm like, I feel seen. When they're like, my friend got pregnant, it's a teen pregnancy. I'm literally 32.
My friends always say that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But we somehow think that we're teenagers. We haven't really accepted how old we really are. And I do think that that's partly because of the infantilization of our economic situation. Our parents' generation could live in houses at this age. Like, literally, my parents bought a house on 2 journalist salaries in Manchester, like, no problem.
So true. I went on a family holiday to Portugal last month to visit my sister who lives there, but my parents essentially paid for the hotel and our flights. And we were like, no, we'll pay, we'll pay. And they were like, absolutely not. Like, we're together as a family, we'll pay. You know, it wasn't extravagant. It was just to like Faro in Portugal. But it was really lovely. But I literally felt like a kid. And I remember thinking as I was walking through the hotel at one point, being like, how can I possibly have a child when I am being taken on holiday by my parents?
Oh, literally. Me and Marlon were saying that last year. We went on holiday with my family and I'm like, oh my God, we are actual children. We are the kids in the back of the car. This is absurd.
Yes.
We're meant to be parents. What the hell?
And they were, and we, and also when you're around your parents, you revert back to like,
childhood self.
Me and my sister were like having little mini breakdowns. Yeah, bickering, stupid breakdowns about things that don't matter. Yeah.
Me and my brother had a row on our family holiday, a screaming match at the table. Makes you feel really grown up, doesn't it? That?
And I like, I can't, like, I would never do this normally, but every time that I left my room, I locked my hotel key inside my room. And I was just like, why am I like not thinking properly? Like,
why am I suddenly an incapable child?
Yeah, exactly. And my mum would be like, oh, you've locked your hotel key again.
You better get out. Eleanor, another key.
Yeah.
The poor little silly girl. So to close that point from our lovely listener, she has asked, so I'm going to ask you, if it's not too much, it would be so interesting to hear how you both think working in the media has impacted your experience of aging and self-image. I have found that as a 31-year-old, I'm still so susceptible to it all. And this is someone that has a PhD in gender and economic history, so is very much saying that, you know, consciously she should know better, but subconsciously we take in so much of this toxic narrative that you can't help but be influenced by it. Do you think your self-perception of aging has been impacted by working in the media?
My perception of aging has been totally shaped by social media and unrealistic portrayals of aging. And as we've just said, completely losing our sense of what a real face is at our age.
It's like the trend now of untouched at 30. Why is that a trend? Untouched at 30. That's most people I know. Most people I know haven't had work done. Why suddenly is that a radical statement to make online that your face is untouched at 30?
It's absolutely wild. And yet in the majority of my friendship group, I probably am in now the minority of being untouched.
It's so funny. That's why I actually love chatting about these kind of things with you, because we come from really different places.
We do.
Which you wouldn't think that we would. We actually have very different like reference points in terms of our friendship groups.
We do have very different friends. Yeah, I probably am in the minority now. Am I shaped? But the media definitely has shaped my view on motherhood, in that the media really runs on negative stories. That's what people click on. Essentially, clickbait is driven by negativity. So of course, what sells in the media is negative stories. So yes, my experiences of reading about motherhood in the media tend to be negative and clickbaity. But aging, I would say no.
Yeah, see, I think she's getting at whether working in the media has impacted it rather than just generally being consumers of media.
Right, I see. I probably wouldn't say that was necessarily specific to the media.
I mean, I know this sounds a bit silly, but it does really all come back to the late stage capitalism debate, I think, because we live in such a rampantly individualistic society that we're just not looking at how we can all work together to make things easier for everyone. To go back to other cultures, as we've said, where it takes a village to raise a child,
yes,
and so many different people are involved in the rearing of children, it's a far healthier setup.
Absolutely. And I am loath to necessarily promote Emirata's podcast because it's had very bad reviews, but there was one episode, I think I've mentioned the podcast before, where she's with Julia Fox, who, as everyone knows, I stan. That's probably why I liked it. Where they talk about how as single mothers, they are very attracted by the idea of raising children in a commune with friends.
Yeah.
Like Julia Fox literally told me in our interview that she lives with female friends, and I think maybe some male ones as well, but they may be queer, and they raise their kids together as single parents.
That's actually amazing.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's so empowering and inspiring, and makes having a kid feel less lonely and scary. Because at the moment, it feels like such an individualistic choice. If you want to have kids, sort out childcare. No one's got anyone's backs.
Exactly.
Everyone's just plowing on, trying to do their own thing. And we're not living as a proper communal species as we should be.
And I think maybe if I thought, okay, no, look, having kids has a greater purpose in that we need to continue the human race, and we're all going to die out unless we, you know, take one for the team and have a kid. But it is really difficult to think that way when the world sucks right now.
Yeah. And like, why the hell should we, quite frankly, as women, especially, why should we take the bloody future of the human race onto our shoulders?
Exactly.
What about bloody men? Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up for this week. We have so many more
men.
Thoughts. We could keep going for another hour, which is precisely what we shall do next week. So please do tune in, guys.
So next episode, we will be talking about perhaps some of the more emotionally complex aspects of parenthood. So whether that be the taboos of regret or feeling like an unnatural parent.
Yep, the thorny issues of egg freezing and IVF.
And we'll also be talking about motherhood in pop culture.
About fatherhood, about male infertility. You know, this is not just a conversation for the women. I think that's really important to state.
So lots to get into. And of course, we'll be reading a lot more of your listener DMs because they've been amazing.
See you next week, guys.
Make sure you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and please DM us at Straight Up Podcast.
We would absolutely love to hear from you. As we said at the beginning, we are very much trying to navigate this strange period of life ourselves, and it is so reassuring hearing from other women, whether or not they've had kids or have chosen not to. Every opinion is so validating, and we really, really love to see it. Thank you.
See you next time.